Okay, so let's get started. Do we have any new people today? I don't think I saw anyone new. Okay, good. So with respect to the agenda, we've received a couple of requests for some modifications to the agenda. I wasn't on last week, so I read through the minutes from the call last week. And since then, some of the requests, I think, that have come in are probably more appropriate for us to discuss than the use case review that is on the current agenda. So let's just discuss that and make sure everyone's okay with adding them. So first, Manu had requested that that we spend some time discussing Christopher Allen's Web of Trust use case. It's issue 32 on the data model. If that's okay, I would like to insert that before the use case. So essentially next. I should say right after status of the Verifiable Claims Working Group vote. Are there any objections to discussing that before we get to the use case review?
I think it's issue 31.
32, I believe. 32 is what Manu sent out. Oh, so excuse me. There are actually two issues. There is one that is in the use case document issue list, and there is another one that is in the VC data model issues list. The one that Manu requested we discuss, let me just put it in here, is in the VC data model list.
Gotcha.
Okay, just to be clear. So that's the one that I'm proposing that we discuss after the status update on the vote. Okay, I'm not hearing any objections, so we'll do that one after the status update. Manu also requested that we spend a little time discussing privacy, and I'll let him explain that. He sent an email to the mailing list, but it has to do with us having received formal objections related to privacy, and he would like to talk about that for a few minutes. Are there any objections to doing that as well after discussing Chris's trust use case? Okay, thank you. We will do that. Okay, so next item then. And thank you, Manu, for helping to fill in. My two other chairs have disappeared on me today, so I appreciate you jumping in there to help out. Okay, Manu, can you give us a status, please, on sort of the vote and where we are?
Sure. Sure. So the vote closed on this past Sunday. We had a fantastically healthy turnout for the vote. I think this may have been the most number of positive votes for any W3C charter in W3C's history. So that is fantastic. I need to go back and check to make sure that's true, but it's way up there. So great turnout. We have received a number of formal objections that were some of which were expected and some of which were a surprise, meaning there were a couple of formal objections from organizations we have not spoken to at all and have not reviewed the work at all, and they may have been misled into thinking that the work is doing something that it's not. So there are most of these formal objections are around privacy, meaning like the formal objections believe that we could greatly damage privacy on the web. And as a result, they didn't want the working group to be created. But those are very much in the minority. Most of these votes were just straight up plus ones for the charter. And a lot of organizations saying that they're going to review and deploy verifiable claims. So great news. overall. The next step is the W3C staff are going to try and talk with the organizations that put in formal objections, and will reach out to us if they need some information from us. And that work's ongoing right now. I got notification from the W3C staff that they're working on it. So yeah, everything's good there. The only thing that we probably need to do is start figuring out how we're going to address some of this privacy stuff, which is what that agenda item later on is going to be about. So that's where we are.
Okay, thank you. Any questions from anyone on the status?
Oh, someone nice. Put us on hold.
Are you able to check that, Manu?
No. Well, there we go. Whoever put us on hold, please don't put us on hold because we hear hold music.
Okay, I'm not seeing any additional questions. Thank you, Manu. That's really good news. Okay, so so let's go on and discuss the the issue on the Web of Trust use case. So again, there's a use case in the use cases issues. But there's actually discussion that's happened on an issue for this topic for the in the data model issues list. So the first person is Christopher. So go ahead, Christopher.
Yeah. So I think it is relevant to quickly. Discuss the use case. So what I tried to do was capture a more modern version of the, the classic use case, PGP use case, where we have someone who wishes to establish, a relationship with the world in a confidential fashion to start off with, acquire various relationships and credentials to prove those relationships, and ultimately choose to set aside some of those some of the anonymity in order to ultimately get a job in her particular field. So I just want to make sure that we, to share with people that the root of this is a desire to replicate that particular use case, which has some definite privacy and confidentiality questions and issues. So I just want to make sure we understand the source. Going through that, I tried to sort of identify some of the early sort of bootstrapping types of things that would be required for that type of relationship to begin and be described and shared. One of the first things that was necessary was sort of the self-signed attribution, which is something that, hadn't been explicitly discussed. What does it mean to be self-signed? Then progressing from there, now you have another party that is basically saying that they know the first party. That's where it gets a little bit more thorny in the sense of, in the classic PGP sense, when you're at a PGP party and you're signing someone else's key, there's some gotchas there that in the classic PGP model that weren't addressed, and you know, even we don't necessarily have a solution for. For instance, you know, it's not just that I'm claiming to know somebody, but what happens if there's some, that's kind of what PGP does now, but you also maybe want to have a proof that the other party has the key, has knowledge of the private key, which, you know, that goes, you know, one more level deeper. And that's where we began. That's where some of the discussions in the data model issue began. I'm done.
Okay, Manu, go ahead.
Right. So given that background, what I tried to do in the issue is map all of those kind of actions that Christopher was talking about down to what the verifiable claim would actually look like and what you could kind of trust the verifiable claim on with respect to the use case, right? So if you look at, let me link to the comment here. So if you look at this issue, here's where I started responding. I think there was a, in Christopher's issue, there was a slight distinction we needed to make between a claim and a credential. We have like three levels of things in the verifiable claims data model. We have verifiable claims. So a verifiable claim is something like a name on a driver's license or your age on a driver's license. Each one of those things is a verifiable claim. We have something that we've been calling an entity credential. And again, the language for this is probably going to change once the working group's spun up. But right now, a credential is a collection of verifiable claims. So where the verifiable claim is the name on your driver's license, an entity credential is a collection of verifiable claims. So the a driver's license is a type of entity credential. And then higher up on the stack, we have these things called identity profiles, so that if you have a bunch of entity credentials, think about the contents of your wallet. If you took the entirety of the contents of your wallet out and put it out on a table, that would be effectively an identity profile. Like you've got multiple verifiable claims, credentials with digital signatures from multiple parties that you can then compose together into a view of you, or a view of the entity. So, you know, there was at some point, Christopher had put a disclaim identifier where it should have been like a discredential identifier and tried to make that distinction there. The next step was to effectively try and create that nose relationship. So at the bottom of that comment, there, I believe that is a quote-unquote properly formed, let me think. That is a properly formed DID descriptor object. And again, this is like not this is not something that we're working on in this group. But the object itself is useful because that is how you would express an entity, like an identity profile. This is exactly what an identity profile looks like. And we do talk about identity profiles in the spec. So what you're looking at the bottom of that example is an identity profile of Alice. Alice has a decentralized identifier, and then you have a list of credentials with signatures on them. And one of those credentials is a statement by Alice that she knows Bob, and then digital signature. So that, I believe, addresses at least that first use case of how does Alice say she knows Bob, and it establishes, you know, cryptographic proof that Alice made that statement or that did made that statement. And then later on, we kind of mix the key fingerprint stuff in there. So let me stop there with that kind of like identity profile object at the bottom there and see if there are any questions from Christopher or anyone else in the group.
Yes, we have someone on the queue. I actually don't know who you are. N-A-G-E, Nage, Nag. Can you just briefly say your name?
George.
Oh, okay, Nathan. All right, thanks. You're up.
One question that I have, and I guess this is for both Christopher and for Manu, is the role that zero-knowledge proofs might be able to play in this. Because when I provide a verifiable claim, I could provide the proof that I have received a verifiable claim from another party, along with the verifiable claim that I'm self-attesting in this case. So, for instance, when I talked to Bob, I could provide Bob with a zero-knowledge proof that someone had verified my contact information or verified my person object, along with the things I was self-attesting to Bob. Could I not?
Well, there's some language questions I have here. So I see zero-knowledge proofs as being kind of a higher-level thing. What you're talking about is, you know, is just a cryptographic proof in some form. That, and this does not satisfy that at this point. There is not, Alice, in effect, in a cryptographic sense, could send a knot saying, prove to me that you actually have possession of the private key, Bob signs that nonce and returns it back to Alice, and Alice now knows that that Bob actually actively at this moment has control of that private key, and that's a cryptographic proof. Upwards from there are some things you can do with a blinded thing there, which is sort of a form of selective disclosure. There's true selective disclosure type techniques for anti-correlation, and then at the highest level we have a true zero knowledge proof type thing, which is a much more complex operation but allows for true anonymity. Part of the challenge here is that we're not actually talking about the crypto. and there's a little bit of language confusion as to, what these different cryptographic proofs mean and can do and what they're called. That help?
Yes, that does help. Thanks. And it seems like there's a couple of things we might be able to talk about offline from this call to see if it's applicable here that might help in the broader discussion.
Okay, thanks. Dave Longley, you're next.
Right. I'll get to my main point in a second. I did want to say, and Moni was also going to talk about this a bit, that zero-knowledge proofs are certainly related to this technology and should be compatible with it, but people can talk about that more. I just wanted to say that the example was missing an issuer property that actually states who actually issued this credential, who's actually the one making the claim. And here's a link I pasted, the example. If you add in the issuer property to the credential, you can see that it's Alice that is the one who's issuing this credential, who's the one who's making the claim. And this is a self-claim. The claim is about Alice. And so I just wanted to make sure that got into the example.
Okay, thanks. That was Dave Longley, Matt. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, right, okay. Manu, you're up.
Right, so Nathan, to respond, there are multiple places that zero-knowledge proofs can be used, both in the verifiable claims themselves and in like a protocol. So I think what would be most helpful is defining like what the data model and the format for these zero-knowledge proofs look like so that we can try them out in the verifiable claims model. Like Dave Longley said, verifiable claims should absolutely be compatible with ZKPs, but we need to start getting some, like, we're going to have a working group. We need to start being very specific from a technical perspective so that we ensure interoperability, especially when it comes to verifiable claims and ZKPs. So to that end, at the last rebooting Web of Trust, Jason Law and myself, Jason Law is from Eminem, same company that Nathan's with, and I sat down and looked at pseudo-anonymous signature scheme. And we tried to get the Kamenich-Lisinskaya-style signatures a preliminary spec worked out for them. And what that would enable is for pseudonymous signatures to be able to be used here. So we'd be able to use pseudonymous identifiers and pseudonymous signatures. The thing that's really important, I think, for people in the group to understand is that DIDs, by their very nature, are pseudonymous at best, right? The second you have, you start expressing these relationships, so the second you express like a name or, even something that, as safe as like a zip code, they fall out of kind of the pseudonymous realm or can. So yes, zero knowledge proofs, as Christopher's saying, are not cryptographic proofs. The verifiable claim stuff is primarily focusing on cryptographic proof that one identifier associated with a public key made a statement at a specific point in time. So all that to say, we have to be very, very careful about zero knowledge proofs. This is what the W3C membership came back and formally objected on, right? And we have to, and many of the responses were like, why aren't you using Microsoft UProof? Why aren't you using zero knowledge proofs that protects people's privacy? And the position this group has had for a long time, or I believe where the consensus is we have to be very, very careful when we say a technology protects a person's privacy, because there are very simple ways to defeat that. Even if you're using things like zero knowledge proofs, right? So we have to be very careful about saying technology X will provide privacy Y. We have to do a very thorough analysis before we say things like that. But all that said, yes, absolutely, we want verifiable claims to be used in ZKP type settings. But the R&D on that is still very much in its early days.
Okay, thanks. Just a brief interrupt. Christopher, you'll be next. I figure we'll let this conversation go until quarter till, and then we'll switch to the privacy one. So in about 7 or 8 minutes, I'm going to start looking for any kind of wrap-up or conclusion on this topic. Christopher, you're next.
Yeah, and I think that I have some concerns. I mean, yes, I want the data format, which is our focus, to be able to express the ability to do zero knowledge proofs, or at least have a reasonable chance of addressing some of those types of things. But in fact, these zero knowledge proofs and things of that nature are very new cryptographically. There are a variety of complexities and issues of protocols and other things to allow them to function, and I don't want that perfection to get in the way of the good of just being able to have pseudo-anonymous, low cryptography claims, which is what a DID can do. I don't want it to get in the way of some simple blinded claims a la you know, you prove, you know, Chalmian style blinding, et cetera. You know, so, you know, let's be very careful and not get totally lost there. The big thing that I feel like is still missing from this is, you know, the question that I had of, you know, how, you know, there's that nonce that I talked about. I'm not really talking about the cryptographic nonce, which still kind of irritates me in the signature spec, but the and maybe this, that's the place to put the nonce. But there is the question of a simple cryptographic proof that the other party has possession of the private key isn't really expressed, you know, proves that they've, and please, not zero-knowledge proof, it's just a proof of that the other party has possession of the private key. And then, you know, the counter to that is that you now have the next step past these ones that Manu and Dave wrote are the ones where it's done in return. The two parties say they know each other. And then finally is making sure that everybody knows that this is, you know, no names have been shared here. No, you know, no Christopher A. said he knows at Manu or any of this nature. It's simply this cryptographic entity, which holds private key, knows acknowledges and is making statements about someone else's cryptographic key is the baseline of a simple pseudo-anonymous identity. That's it.
Okay, thanks. Joe, you're next.
So my question is about the user tests or use cases around revoking or amending this claim. Manu, I appreciated your feedback that, you know, we don't depend on ledgers innately in terms of what a verifiable claim is. But if I'm looking at this example, and this is a claim that's in JSON-LD on my screen, I'm just curious, how do we talk about how this would be revoked or amended when this is what it is and there is not innately a ledger anywhere?
Okay, Manu.
Right, so to respond to Christopher first and then Joe, Christopher, there's an example later on down in that document about how we do the public key thing, like make a statement about Bob's public key at the time that Alice makes the statement that Alice knows Bob. So we can get to that in a bit. I don't know if we'll be able to get to all of it today, but in general, I believe we've got your use case covered in multiple ways. The question in my mind is, how do we want to, what's the best practice, right? So there are multiple ways to solve the use case that you're outlining, Christopher. I think we're happy to go through and show the various mechanisms, but then we have to come up with like a best practice on how to do that. So I think we can continue the conversation in that issue. I just wanted to make sure that, you know, Christopher isn't saying, I don't see any way this is possible. Rather, it's I would like to know exactly what the markup looks like. The first case is concerning. The latter case is just a matter of time before we get to it. To address Joe's question about, you know, this is kind of a decentralized ledger this is decentralized ledger markup, that's absolutely true. So the only reason I use the decentralized ledger, like DIDS, the only reason I use that in the examples is that's where Christopher started. But everywhere it says DID colon in here, Joe, we can replace with an HTTP-based URL. So it can be HTTPS, you know, example, or, you know, Alice, the credential ID can be at an HTTP-based URL, and so on and so forth. When you do that, you lose some data portability characteristics. And that's why we're not very fond of those approaches. But there are other companies that have said that they want to do that. There are, like, for example, if this is used in an enterprise setting, there are enterprises that are saying, we don't want our credentials being used outside of our organization, and we want them locked down to the intranet, right? We absolutely do not want them on a decentralized ledger. So there are valid use cases for both, you know, ledger-based identifiers and kind of centralized identifiers. Does that help, Joe?
Halfway does. I mean, I definitely get that the DIDs are just URLs and they could be replaced with other URLs and it's still valid. But it seems to me if there is not a referenceable live source of information about this claim, you can't amend it or revoke it. And a ledger is one of the ways that we do that. You do it through just having a website that you're saying this is authoritative, but am I on the right page about that clarification?
So Dave answered your question in IRC if you didn't see it. There is a link to a revocation list or a revocation ledger. That link is the ID itself for the for the credential. So unfortunately, I don't have a line number I can point at, but see this thing here, provide, here's an example of a credential identifier. So there's at the minimum, there's that identifier, but Christopher has raised the point that he doesn't think that we should conflate the revocation list with the identifier itself, which is, I think, a valid point. So we may have another identifier in the credential that specifically says revocation list and then provides the URL. That URL may be to a decentralized ledger, or the URL may be to a website that has, you know, strong uptime guarantees, right? For example, like, you know, Google would have a revocation list that it runs for its email-based credentials, and it would be a URL that would have, you know, be running in multiple data centers with, you know, live testing and all that other kind of stuff. So,
sure.
Yeah, and Johnny Crunch also makes a valid point. It could be the multi-adder stuff in IPFS. There are many ways of doing revocation lists.
Okay, before I act the next person, which will be Manu, guys, we need to start focusing on what is sort of the next step here to take, whether it's more discussion on the issue list or whatever. So Manu, you're
sorry,
next,
I was,
unless you just covered that. You did sort of talk
about
that already.
I covered that, yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
done.
Okay. So I think, I think Christopher is next. Just a sec, we had some in and outs on the queue here. Yes, Christopher, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to make it clear that I think it depends on the DID method in the sense that at least in the 5 or 6 DID methods that are being developed right now, you know, each would have potentially slightly different ways that, you know, revocation or revision is accepted. So, you know, and that's part of what, you know, is useful and a problem in the DID method specs, because there might be multiple ways to do it. In the case of the simplest method, which is the BTC1 or whatever, there is not a revocation of a specific claim. The whole thing is revoked and replaced by a new one. So you can, you know, which is a one way of doing it. But it wouldn't be a revocation list or, you know, a proof of revocation or some of that type of things in one of the DID, for instance, that I'm working on. So it wouldn't be a separate field. It would be a, you know, when you validate the DID phase itself, that you discover that, you know, that attribute is no longer available. It's gone. And you may have assigned one from in the past, and you may be able to not, you may be able to do some non-repudiation on that signed one in the past, but it's not in the current DID DEO set, then, you know, it's not there.
Okay, thank you. Dave, you're next.
Right, I just wanted to summarize and say that revocation, how you do revocation may depend largely on who's making the claims, what types of claims they're making, and a variety of other things. Because certain types of claims or credentials might have unlinkability characteristics that need different kinds of revocation mechanisms. You know, it really depends on the type of credential or claim. Our job is to make sure that we can express in our data model and in our syntax every possible way that people might need to be able to do this kind of revocation, and that we can do it in a machine-readable way that's consistent, so that anyone who wants to support checking revocation lists or whatever other method there is can write a client that can read this information and find out how you go about doing revocation for a particular issuer or a particular type of credential. So we need to make sure that our data model is well-suited to express that information, but we don't necessarily want to say there is only one way of doing this. We want to be able to say, we can say all the different ways of doing this. You can read this in a machine-readable way and in a consistent way, and then if your software supports an implementation to go about checking that revocation, it'll work.
Okay, thanks. Manu, I think Manu has some comments and is going to try to sum up.
So
propose a way forward.
Yeah, plus one to what Dave Longley just said, you know, we can't mandate, you know, one or N ways. We can just make it machine readable. So total agreement there. I guess the question is, you know, Christopher, do you feel like we address the use case that you raised? And if you don't, you know, we should discuss further, but I think in the issue, right? So I think at this point, kind of the onus is on you to tell us if we're not meeting this use case, or if there's something that is not clear about how we address the use case. But I think we can have all of that discussion in the issue tracker. Do you agree?
I believe we're making progress. I think there are some subtleties and other things that, you know, need to be, you know, matured in the sense of the cryptographic proof of knowledge of the private key is the magic bullet I'm searching for right now, and then the counter signing, which may give that. I don't know. Anyhow, those. With that, then I can actually we can actually implement that using simple Bitcoin-based DIDs, and you know, basically be able to say, hey, you know, we're doing at least the first part of what a legacy system does, but in a superior way, you know, begin to, you know, build on top of that other kinds of claims, like, you know, a preponderance of people who, a preponderance of keys are making claims that somebody is a person, and you happen to personally know one of those people as a person, and thus, you know, within some degree of web of trust, you can believe that the other people that claim to be a person in this network are a person as opposed to just a key. So, you know, that would be the next claim, you know, DID is a person.
So, Christopher, again, is this discussion that can continue on the issue tracker list at this point?
Yes, it can continue there. Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you. It doesn't mean that we won't come back and talk about it on the call again, but it's probably a good time to have some more of that discussion happen on the issue tracker. Okay. Thank you, everyone. Good discussion. I just wanted to make sure we had enough time to move on to the other issue that that we wanted to touch on today, the other topic, and that is something that Manu had, prioritization of response to privacy concerns. Manu, do you want to just tell us a little bit about this and what you had in mind?
Sure. So this has to do with the formal objections that we got at W3C. Most everyone that formally objected to the work, there was still some, like, we don't believe you have incubated the work long enough there, but people seem to have moved from that as the reason not to start the work to we will destroy privacy as we know it on the web if we continue with this work, right? There's this very strong backlash from organizations, you know, privacy hawks, that the work that we're doing could fundamentally damage the web. So we've always, there are many people in this group that have always cared very deeply about privacy, and we care about pseudonymity. But we have not been very good at messaging that we care about it as deeply as we do. So, you know, we should at some level start responding to these privacy concerns, right? One, since the privacy sections of the spec are not filled out, so we should probably have people start filling that information out so it's clear, at least more clear, that we have thought about these concepts, at least to the degree that we can, right? So there are multiple things happening here, or I'll put it in a couple of categories. The first assertion is the use of any kind of long-lived identifier, cross-origin identifier, is a danger to privacy, meaning the DID itself is unacceptable. Right, we should be recreating identifiers when we connect to different websites, and we should not be promoting any system that allows cross-origin identifiers. Clearly, the group has thought about that. An email address is a cross-origin identifier. We use email addresses to log into every single website. This ecosystem already exists. But the concern is that we're going to make the problem worse by making it easier to use identifiers that allow linkability between origins. When that assertion is made, when people are saying we're damaging privacy by using cross-origin identifiers, usually things like Kamenish Lisinski or U-Proof technologies are brought in as a, you should be doing this instead. You should be standardizing U-Proof. You should not be standardizing verifiable claims. Right, but the problem there is that U-Proof and the Kamenish Lisinski style signatures do not solve the use cases that people are saying are the problem. Right, so it is very easy to accidentally expose information that allows you to be tracked via zero knowledge proofs or via Kamenish Lisinski style signatures. Any of these, you know, quote unquote, privacy-enhancing technologies can be used to expose people's information without their knowledge. So we have to be very careful and thorough about how we talk about that. There are certainly cases where those are helpful. Those technologies are helpful, and they're kind of ecosystems that are controlled where you can be fairly pseudo-anonymous. But we don't talk about this in the spec anywhere, and we don't have a document that has done a privacy analysis. So, you know, all this to basically raise awareness in the group that people outside of this group do not think that we're doing a good job when it comes to privacy. And as a result of that, we're probably going to have to put a bit more effort into explaining the privacy characteristics of the technology that we're creating.
Okay, thanks, Manu. We've got about 3 minutes for open discussion before we need to figure out what our next steps are. Christopher.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other thing I really want to emphasize here is that privacy is an overloaded word. So there are many approaches to addressing privacy. And we're also a little crippled by that we're currently being requested mainly to focus on the data format, whereas a lot of privacy issues have to do with protocols and things of that nature. So, for instance, you know, one of the reasons why in some communities we don't use U3 is because it's a centralized mechanic. We would prefer to use data minimization. There are other forms of, anti-correlation. And one of the things that we've got, a complexity here to directly go to a white paper that Joe Andrews, co-author of leader of, is, identity is correlation. It is both our friend and our enemy. So on one hand, you're trying to prove correlation that such and such credential is true. And on the other hand, you're trying to avoid proving anything that is not, and allow other correlations to be attached to it. So on one hand, you're correlating as a deliberate part of this process, and on the other hand, you're trying to not allow certain kinds of correlations. You're supposed to be talking about the data format. And a lot of these other things require protocols to give that level of confidence in it. So it's a tough area.
Okay. Thanks, Christopher. Adam, be brief if you can.
Sure. the idea that damaging privacy by using cross-domain identifiers, to me, amounts to saying that we're not doing it better, so therefore we're doing it worse, which is just nonsense. I mean, basically, cross-domain identifiers are the way we're today. If people keep doing it that way using this technology, it's just the same. It's not worse. We're not doing bad. Secondly, users are free to establish as many identifiers and profiles as they like. So there's nothing to say that, just because we allow somebody to reuse a digital identifier doesn't mean that they have to. And thirdly, privacy isn't secrecy or anti-correlation. It's liberty and control, which means that users can use a cross-domain identifier if they want. Maybe I want to use the same identifier across three or four different organizations because I want them to track my behavior across those organizations. That's privacy. Privacy isn't precluding that from happening. That's my soapbox. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Let me just check the queue. It's empty right now. So what I'd like now is sort of a proposal on what the next step should be. And Manu, I know you had something in mind.
Right. I mean, I think it's just, roll up our sleeves and start writing those privacy sections in the document. I think if we can assign, if folks can volunteer to write two paragraphs on each privacy section, we can assign folks and start getting some language typed out and integrated in the document. I think that's the, putting text in the spec is a demonstration that we have considered this stuff and is at least a good starting point.
Amanda, can you create an issue for each section that needs more work and then
already done.
Reply? Okay.
That has already been done, and what we can do, all I need is volunteers, and I can go in and assign issues to the volunteers, specific privacy issues to the volunteer, and then it's up to the volunteer to write, two paragraphs about it. Adrian's volunteering. I will, of course, volunteer.
Oh, I'm clearly volunteering, but I need to kind of look at the whole thing.
Okay.
So, that's fine. As the one somewhat retired cryptographer in the room.
So, Manu, okay. Just a clarification. The issues you're referring to are the large number of privacy issues, that placeholders essentially, that are already on the issue tracker, right?
Yeah, here are the privacy issues that we're tracking.
Yeah, there's like 10
right
of them or
now.
So.
Yep. So there's a link to it for those that have volunteered. And honestly, if you can assign yourself to one of those, if you volunteered and you can assign one of those to yourself, that would be great. And just assign one. Let's start with one per person.
Yeah, if you are having trouble assigning yourself, just start writing into the issue, and Manu and I and the chairs can make sure that you get assigned. Okay. Any final questions, comments on this topic? Okay, thank you. Is there anything else that anyone needs to announce before we end the call?
Yeah, I just like to say that I'm beginning work on some of these. So if you're interested in beginning to code, play around with these, let me know.
And that was Christopher, right?
Yes, sorry.
Okay, thank you. No problem, just making sure for the minutes. Okay, Nathan.
So to say something somewhat similar to what Christopher just said, the Sovereign Foundation has also opened up a couple of working groups that are working with some issues around trying to start exchanging these sorts of verifiable claims and zero-knowledge proofs. So welcome to join us over there as well.
Okay, thank you. Johnny has a question. If anyone wants to answer, when is the rebooting the Web of Trust in Paris, and what other conferences happening that week?
Sure. This is Christopher Allen. It's April 21st through 23rd, which is basically Friday, Saturday, Sunday. There's a day, 2 days off, Monday and Tuesday, followed by Euro Security and Privacy, which is Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, followed by Security and Blockchain, Security and Blockchains, which is a workshop on Sunday, and then on Saturday, and then Eurocrypt starts Sunday, and I think goes through Thursday. So it's a it's a whole series of slightly different subcultures and groups starting 21st in Paris.
All right, thanks. One final comment here. Remember, please do work on the issues in the issue tracker. That's both for the use cases and for the data model specification. We were able to have this discussion today because of some work that had happened on the issue tracker that allowed us to physically look at what was there and make some progress before the call. So just a reminder to do that. Thank you, everyone. Talk with you next week.
Thanks all. Bye.
All right, bye-bye.
Cheers.